Although we often perceive reality as being subject to randomness and chance, physicist Dave Goldberg believes in an essential and underlying orderliness. Hidden symmetries can be found everywhere, from the Higgs boson to the most massive galaxies. Professor Goldberg's new book, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, discusses the kind of compelling questions most of us unfortunately stopped asking during our sophomore year in college. Questions such as, why is there something instead of nothing? And are the present, past, and future our only options? His book is published by Dutton, and I'm very pleased that it brings Dave Goldberg to our show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Can we look at the universe in a rearview mirror? Is it closer than it appears?
It's a lot closer than it appears, and it's a lot more similar than you might otherwise guess.
But aren't things moving away from each other at an increasingly faster rate?
Well, I mean, of course, there's the literal sense of looking at things like the most distant galaxies. We can certainly look at those, and they get further and further away. And one of the exciting things, of course, about looking at those most distant galaxies is that we're also looking into the past.
So we're seeing the past in the present.
We're seeing the past in the present. In fact, you and I, even a few feet away from each other, are seeing the past in the present, even if it's just a few nanoseconds.
And you say that when we read a book, that there's this little nanosecond split.
It makes history come alive, exactly.
Is it possible for any of us lay readers to truly understand and justify the facts as you lay them out in this book? Wouldn't someone need at least a rudimentary understanding of the mathematical proofs before we could take them as true on anything but faith?
Well, it's an interesting question. I mean, one of the things I think that physicists struggle with a lot is we have these very complicated equations. And, you know, we certainly, in trying to come up with models of reality, we plug through those equations and try to turn that into a sentence. There is a particle that has this or that property, or this is how gravity works. But the reality is that those equations are really a guide to explain to us how things are supposed to work. You're absolutely right. Nobody's going to be able to read a description and say, yes, I'm certain that that's how reality works. But at the same time, what I'm trying to do in this book is walk someone through a plausible scenario of how things are put together. Not just trust me, you know, this is how it really is, but this is why it makes sense to me.
Well, the confusion for me occurs when I'm reading something like Dennis Overby's article in the New York Times a couple of weeks back about the latest debate between the two schools, Einstein and also quantum mechanics, as to what happens to information in a black hole. And both sides have strong arguments. I had no idea what the hell they were talking about. But more important, I thought, how can you even discuss what happens as you enter a black hole if you're only doing it through mathematical equations?
No, that's true. And that's a very interesting point. I mean, you get to two very crucial points there. One is, what should the popular and public debate about science education be in a program like this or in popular books? And one of the things I do try to do in this book is explain what it is that we're really relatively certain of and make all the caveats when we're not. Because when you have a debate amongst two experts, it's not clear how much of that is, well, my equations are better than your equations, or my intuition is better than your intuition, and how is the public to judge? But even at a more fundamental level, how do we envision something like a black hole? You know, at some level, we have to actually see evidence of a black hole. We do, by the way.
But for years, we took it on faith based on Einstein's mathematics.
Oh, you're absolutely right. I mean, this is one of the things that's very exciting with black hole discoveries as the center of the galaxy, for example, or the Higgs boson, or many other things, where you have this expectation of what's supposed to happen, and then finally your observations or experiments sort of get to that level where you can actually see it, and you're like, oh my God, we were right. That experience for science is just incredible.
When a century ago, when Sir Arthur Eddington was asked if it was true that only three people in the world understood Einstein's theory of general relativity, he couldn't come up with a third person other than Einstein himself. How long, on the average, do people need to understand something like that? I mean, even today, I'm sure that a great the majority of people really have no idea. But a lot of people do understand Einstein's theories today.
Sure, sure. I mean, part of it is we've gotten better at understanding it and gotten better at explaining it to our students. So a specialist can learn it in a year or so. A student, that is to say, who's majoring in physics can learn just about as much as Einstein ever knew about general relativity in about a year.
Because now that they all learn the math.
They learn the math.
Even though
we've got a better intuition, you know, all of those things. It isn't expected that everyone is going to learn the underlying math, but relativity does have all these wonderfully interesting predictions, and people can learn about those.
Are most insights into the world a result of a new equation?
No. I mean, I think it almost always – and Einstein's this great example where you have an idea. Something clicks. Einstein called them his Gedanken experiments, where he would just imagine himself in a situation and try to think about how things would look. So for example, he would ask himself, well, you know, what would happen if I was traveling at the speed of light in a rocket ship and I tried to look at myself in a mirror? And starting from those sorts of things, he would just reason through it. It wasn't a matter of taking an equation and going through all the details. At some point, of course, you do go through the details and you make some sort of quantitative prediction. But to get yourself moving, you start with this central idea. And, of course, the central idea in this book is symmetry.
You say that to understand how things work, we have to understand symmetry. Now, the definition of physics is how things work.
Sure.
Now, how would you define symmetry? To me, symmetry simply means I look at your face and the left side and the right side look pretty much equal.
Yeah. I mean, that's basically just about right. I mean, you could say it in a slightly different way, which is if you took at my face, you held it up to a mirror so it was flipped, it would look the same as it did before. The mathematician Hermann Weyl came up with a definition very much like that. And so the idea of symmetry in physical law is that there are all sorts of things that nature is going to be symmetric if you do it, if you make a certain change. So if you take the universe and you look at it in a rearview mirror, if you flip everything, then the laws of nature don't suddenly change. Or if you take everything in the universe and move it 10 feet to the left, nothing should appear very different or different at all. But then there are some things that are incredibly surprising that they are symmetries, that if you could somehow do this to the universe, nothing would appear to change. There's this mysterious substance called antimatter, for example. It shows up in science fiction all the time, antimatter drives. And it sounds very scary because when matter and antimatter collide, boom, they annihilate. But
are we seeing those collisions?
We can see them. We can make them in a lab. We can make anti-atoms. We can make anti-hydrogen and anti-helium in a lab.
I've met a few anti-people in my time.
Yeah, I know. And if you shake their hands, it can be explosive. But the reality is that even though it sounds incredibly dangerous, it sounds incredibly exotic, if you were all of a sudden you were some divine being, were able to turn all of the matter in the universe to antimatter and vice versa, nothing substantial would change. This is a very surprising symmetry when you first hear about it, for the simple reason that it makes us question why we're here in the first place. We are made of matter, not antimatter. So how come matter gained the upper hand? This thing that's almost symmetric, those are the most interesting things, the things that are almost symmetric, provide a useful universe.
My guest is Dave Goldberg, who is where are you teaching these days?
I'm a professor at Drexel University.
His book, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, How Hidden Symmetries Shape Reality, is published by Dutton. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Well, I was thinking about symmetry in people, and they often say that we think the most beautiful things are faces, for example, the ones that are most symmetrical.
Sure.
And our bodies look symmetrical, but our heart is on the right side.
Our heart is, and the double helix of
the left side. I'm sorry.
Yeah, well, I thought you meant the correct side, but yeah, I mean the double helix of DNA only spirals a particular way. We're only able, by the way, to ingest sugars that have a particular orientation. There's a lot of superficial symmetries, but underneath, there's little asymmetries. Our heart is off to one side, for example. Those just seem to be accidents of history, just how we happen to evolve. But some of them can be really quite profound. One example is it doesn't matter in a country if we decide to drive on the left side of the road or the right side of the road. But it does matter if some people decide to drive on the left and some people decide to drive on the right. So
Americans in Great Britain.
Exactly. You don't want to build a bridge between the two of them without having some sort of crossover in between. So while symmetries can sometimes be broken, things that shouldn't matter one way or the other, nature picks one perhaps arbitrarily and you're stuck with it.
Well, is the circle the most symmetrical object?
Well,
we know
in two dimensions the circle is, in three dimensions is a sphere. But yeah, I mean this is of course how a wheel works, because no matter how you turn it, it's the same distance to the ground.
And that's why Aristotle assumed that the Earth, well, that the Sun would orbit the Earth in a circle.
The Sun would orbit the Earth. The planets would orbit the Earth. The stars would all orbit the Earth. And he set up a beautifully symmetric system. I mean, the ancients had this idea that symmetry must somehow be important, and Aristotle thought, hey, you know, circle is the most symmetric object. If everything is arranged in a series of circles or spheres, that would be a very beautiful universe, one I would like to live in.
But then it doesn't turn out to be that way. Forget about whether the sun goes around Earth. Earth goes around the sun, but in an elliptical fashion.
Well, that's right.
So symmetry, doesn't that undermine the whole theory of your book, how hidden symmetries shape reality? Or is the ellipse a hidden symmetry?
It is a hidden symmetry. So, for example, the actual orbit around the sun isn't symmetric because it's an ellipse. And those are forgetting an ellipse is sort of an elongated version of a circle. But gravity itself is symmetric. Gravity operates in all directions and in all directions with equal strength. So what you see isn't necessarily symmetric, but what causes it is symmetric. And that's why, I mean, we have this universe with this beautiful structure. I mean, I gave the example of matter and antimatter before. You know, it would be unfortunate, of course, if we had exactly the same amount of matter and antimatter, because all would eventually annihilate and we wouldn't be here. So while the laws may be basically symmetric, we like the fact that these symmetries sometimes get broken.
Well, how is gravity symmetrical? Gravity pulls us down, doesn't send us up equally.
No, it doesn't. It doesn't operate the same in all directions, or in all up versus down, but toward the center of the Earth. I mean, to Australians, of course, we are being pulled up from their perspective.
One of the main things that you do in this book is examine some of our best science fiction images and ideas in the light of real science. Many of us in college wondered if our whole universe couldn't be just an atom in a much bigger universe, and that concept was visually dramatized at the end of Men in Black. And you say that's not a possibility?
It's not a possibility. You know, one of the things that's very surprising and very funny when you start looking at some of the great scientists in history, and in particular I'm thinking of Galileo here, is the funny problems that they sort of set before them. And Galileo, one of the greatest minds who ever lived, wanted to ask the question whether giants were possible, which is basically the same question. Note, can something like us exist on a dramatically different scale? And he started thinking about what would happen, and he realized, you know, a giant who is much larger, their bones, you know, if their bones were, say, 10 times longer, would have to be 1,000 times more massive, but only 100 times stronger. And that wouldn't work. The giants would collapse under their own weight. And, you know, this is why Spider-Man is not a great concept, because you take a spider and make it human-sized and it's going to collapse under its own weight as well. Sorry. So scale seems to be very important. I mean, so Galileo, thinking about this, says, well, there does seem to be sort of the right size that a person-shaped can be. And he even thought about it a little bit further, and with I'm going to paraphrase here, with this delightful imagery of saying, you know, as a result, I'm pretty sure that a small dog could carry two or three dogs of his own size, but I doubt that a horse could carry even one horse of his size. And unfortunately, he didn't give a drawing of that, although that would have been great.
But I've always wondered why insects, which are small and light, aren't pulled down by gravity.
Well, I mean, they are pulled down by gravity. They're just pulled down much, much, much less.
But they're easy, it's easier for them to escape gravity than it is for me.
Oh, sure. Because, again, if an insect, you know, the mass of an insect, the amount by which gravity affects them ultimately, goes as if you make them one-tenth the size in each direction, since we live in three dimensions, well, hopefully you don't have an insect that's a tenth as big as you, but that makes them 1,000 times lighter. But they've got – their legs are only 1/100 the surface area, which means that they are proportionally much, much stronger. So they can get away with not having our internal skeletons to keep them firm, basically.
Getting back to matter and antimatter, mm-hmm. They appear in the Star Trek series.
Sure.
The Starship Enterprise is always dealing with antimatter. Dan Brown's Angels and Demons also deals with it. Did they get it right?
Well, I mean, he got a lot of it right, which is – it would be extremely dangerous if somebody was running around with a big vial of antimatter. But only because the amounts that he imagined people were able to produce in a lab and contain was in excess by something like 1 million or so of what we're actually able to produce here on Earth.
Should I assume there's antimatter in this room right now?
Not necessarily. There's antimatter produced in the sun, but typically there's not antimatter down near the surface of the Earth. Things get created up in the upper atmosphere, for example, but by the time you get to the surface of the Earth, it's basically calmed down.
Well, how is antimatter used in Star Trek?
Well, it's used by the thing that makes it most scary. So when matter and antimatter collide, they annihilate completely. You know, Einstein's great equation, E equals mc squared, tells you how much of that energy is liberated. The idea is c, the speed of light, is a whopping huge number, which means that a little tiny bit of matter creates an enormous amount of energy. And since both particle and antiparticle are annihilated completely, you're able to create a huge amount of energy.
I remember just a few years back people debating whether it would ever be possible to travel faster than the speed of light. And the final decision was Einstein was right, we can't.
Are you referring to the neutrino results from a few years ago? So, yeah, there was a result a few years ago where a group believed that they had measured a very, very light particle called a neutrino traveling faster than light. They weren't sure. They had a lot of caveats, and they were basically asking the rest of the physics community to figure out where they screwed up because they didn't believe really that anything traveled faster than light. And there were tons and tons of papers put out, people trying to figure out how relativity might be adapted. And at the end of the day, it turned out that the entire result was just based on a bunch of loose cables. It was very disheartening result.
My guest is Dave Goldberg, who is a professor and director of undergraduate studies in the Department of Physics at Drexel University. His book, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, How Hidden Symmetries Shape Reality, is published by Dutton. We'll continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. And we are back with Dave Goldberg, Professor Dave Goldberg. His book, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, How Hidden Symmetries Shape Reality, it is published by Dutton. Let's get back to Einstein. And I also want to talk about the continuing problem of reconciling Einstein's view of the world with quantum mechanics' view of the world. Does Einstein's equation A equals mc squared describe a rate of conversion between time and space?
Well, it's not so much between time and space, but between matter and energy. But it turns out that time and space have a very similar relationship. So when you delve into some science fiction, you'll frequently hear something that shows up in science fact, which is the idea of a light year, right? Sounds very much like a year. It's just how far light can travel in a year. Light is sort of the yardstick by which we measure everything else. So it is actually pretty easy to convert between time and space. It's just that for us, for human scales, we travel through time so much more than we travel through space. The distance to the sun, for example, is about 8 light minutes, but it takes us 365 days to travel around the sun. So it's a much, much longer a longer trip in time than space.
And it took the occurrence of the transit of Venus to make it possible for astronomers to measure the distance of the sun.
Yeah, to measure it accurately. So one of the big quests in history is to try to figure out what the conversion factor was. So in order to do that, we need to do something like figure out the scale of the solar system. And that involved a very special event that occurs every 120 years or so, or twice every 120 years or so at eight-year intervals, where Venus passes in front of the face of the sun, and you can stand on different points on the Earth and triangulate basically the distances, all the distances in the solar system from one measurement.
I mentioned the sophomore question, why is there something instead of nothing? But isn't a vacuum nothing?
A vacuum, you know, we think of a vacuum as nothing. I got to say, even as a physicist, I still think of a vacuum as nothing, even when I know a vacuum isn't nothing. The vacuum as we understand it in physics is this incredible bubbling cauldron. Particles get created, particles and I should add antiparticles get created and destroyed constantly from the vacuum. The vacuum is in some sense the rule book that describes how space and time operate, how physics operates. So while we think of the vacuum as nothing, you could just as easily think of it as the entire backdrop of the universe. It is the thing that tells us everything.
Well, we used
physics.
To believe that all of space was a vacuum. Now we think it's filled with stuff, don't we?
Well, we think it's – you mean dark matter?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So we used to think it was very, very empty. All of our direct measurements suggested that there wasn't enough matter to even hold together galaxies. And in the 1920s, a physicist by the name of Fritz Zwicky started conjecturing that there might be more stuff out there than meets the eye, basically. This was known as dark matter. And as the years have gone on, almost a century now, the evidence for dark matter has basically become irrefutable. And you're right that there's way more dark matter out there, there seems to be, than there is ordinary matter by about a factor of five. So, yeah, I mean, space is way less empty than we might otherwise have thought. But well outside of galaxies, even dark matter gets very, very, very sparse.
A listener wonders if you have any thoughts on the fact that time just goes one way, whereas we can travel in any direction in space. Or is that a problem for philosophers?
Well, it's a problem for philosophers, but fortunately physicists get to weigh in on it too. As it happens, this was a central question in Chapter 2 in my book, which talks about the arrow of time. So one thing that's very surprising when you think about time as a scientist is time itself acts as a symmetry. You and I could throw a ball back and forth and it makes an arc through the air. And if we play the movie of that backwards, the arc would look the same as if we – equally valid as if we played it forward. But – and the laws of physics all seem to be that way. But yet we remember the past. We don't remember the future. And the one big distinction between the past and the future from a physics point of view isn't grounded in the laws of physics at all. It's grounded in what's known as the second law of thermodynamics, which is basically – I'm going to give you the rough version – which is things get more disordered over time. So one way of thinking about it is – things were less disordered yesterday. They'll be more disordered tomorrow. If we want to figure out what the direction of time is, maybe time is guaranteed to make entropy increase. Hard to say. We don't really know what causes it. We just know that it is the case, and that is what makes time distinct from space. Because after all, we can move in both directions in space and not in both directions in time.
Although you say that the first Terminator movie was a great example of theoretical time travel, while Back to the Future was not.
Well, yeah. I mean, so
– well, one involved an old car. Maybe that was the reason. DeLoreans – nobody drives DeLoreans anymore.
So I should say – before people start getting very, very angry, Back to the Future is a great movie, even if it doesn't have great time travel.
Well, Superman can't exist either.
And hey, watch your mouth.
Well, he used to leap, and now he flies.
No, that's right. No, I'm a huge fan of Superman. I won't abide by anybody saying anything bad about him. But as far as time travel, and time travel may in fact be impossible. In fact, there's a lot of reasons to believe that time travel may be impossible. But Einstein's theory of general relativity, that's the theory of gravity, allows us the possibility that time travel might happen, because the idea is that masses and energies bend space-time, basically. And if you do it just right, maybe they can bend back on themselves.
And that was actually ascertained, that was proven through experiments, Rutherford, I think?
Well, no, we know that time gets bent. There's a lot of indirect ways of measuring this. So there's Sir Arthur Eddington, observed a solar eclipse, for example, of light being bent basically around the sun. But we can do all sorts of other things. We can shine lasers up tall buildings, for example, and notice that time is slower near the surface of the Earth than at the top, which is another way of bending space-time. But if you have enough of it and arranged in just the right way of mass and energy, maybe you can go back to the past.
We've had a number of string theorists on the show over the years because there continues to be this attempt to reconcile Einstein's theories with quantum mechanics, and it continues to be rather fruitless. Is string theory the only way to reconcile the two?
Oh, no. There's a number of – so there's different
– And why can't they be reconciled? They both seem to work.
That's right. So when people say Einstein versus quantum mechanics, that's a shorthand.
Well, Einstein had contempt for much of quantum mechanics.
He had contempt, but remember, Einstein was also instrumental in developing some of quantum mechanics. His Nobel Prize is in the photoelectric effect, which at the end of the day is a matter of describing light as a particle. So Einstein did play a very important role in quantum mechanics. But when people talk about Einstein versus quantum mechanics, what they really mean is his theory of general relativity, his theory of gravity compared to quantum mechanics. And there is a problem. General relativity works extremely well. Quantum mechanics, which describes the workings of atoms and things on very small scales and has a probabilistic element, also works extremely well. But that's because in general they're exploring very different regimes. Either gravity is strong or you're on a very small scale. But in places like the centers of black holes, for example, where gravity will both be very, very strong and quantum mechanics and scales are very, very small, we have no idea how physics is supposed to work. Or even more important to sort of our understanding of the universe, at the very beginning of time, the universe was very, very compact. Gravity was immensely strong. Uncertainty, quantum mechanics, also should have been very important. We don't know how to reconcile them.
And we don't know all sorts of things that sophomores ask, like what was it like before the Big Bang? What is the edge of the soul of the universe or whatever, the whole big thing like? Why is everything moving faster rather than slower? But I want to get to another topic. You devote a chapter to a woman named Emmy Noether. And you rank her as one of the premier figures of physics, and yet I would assume that practically nobody in our audience has ever heard of her.
Nobody in most of my classes would have heard of her. Emmy Noether is one of these people who, as a physics major, mathematicians, by the way, I think she's quite famous amongst mathematicians. She had an enormous impact. She herself was a mathematician. But like many mathematicians in the early 20th century, she made a huge impact on physics.
Now, does Larry Summers know about this?
Didn't
he say that women aren't good at math or science?
Perhaps he would say that she's the exception. But, I mean, she was absolutely amazing. And, you know, the Larry Summerses of her time, you know, made things very, very difficult for her. I mean, just a bit of background. So she was of college age in 1900. Her father was also a math professor at Erlangen University in Bavaria. And basically, there was a rule that women could not enroll in math courses. She had to audit all of her classes, take her exams on her own. None of the structure of the university was available to her. And of course, she aced them. Even once she'd gotten her PhD in 1908, she was in a position where she couldn't get a position anyway. Her genius was already recognized. I mean, she was making these wonderful contributions. People like David Hilbert, who was incredible, one of the most important mathematicians of the time, fully recognized her genius, and yet she wasn't able to get a position. She just sat at home, essentially, substituting for her father occasionally and writing papers and coming up with ideas.
And the reason she comes into your book is because her theories deal with symmetries?
Exactly right. So So Noether eventually was brought into Göttingen University by David Hilbert, in large part to help understand Einstein's theory of general relativity. One of the things that was very surprising, I mean, they just to be clear, Göttingen was unwilling to pay her under any circumstances for something like another 15 years. But one of the things that was remarkable is she started thinking about how symmetry worked. A lot of her research had been on symmetry, and a lot of this got related to physical law. And she came up with what is known as these days as Noether's theorem, which usually a physicist will see in their junior level class, and it'll be mentioned very quickly and then just forgotten about. But it's incredibly important. All of these ideas like supersymmetry and things like that you might hear about, they're all based on her work. And so the idea of Noether's theorem is basically all of these symmetries that we talk about, the fact that the laws of physics are the same at all times or in all places in the universe or at all directions, they lead to what are known as conservation laws. And conservation laws you might have an intuitive idea for. Just think of it in terms of money. I have $20 in my wallet. I spend $5 on a cup of coffee. Without looking, I know how much money is left in my wallet because it adds up to the same. And it's useful for doing calculations, but it's also useful for knowing how the universe works. And so we've heard about things like energy conservation. And energy conservation had been known experimentally for something like 100 years before Noether. But what she said was, hey, wait a second. This thing that you're taking for granted is a consequence of the symmetry of the universe, of the fact that in this case, the laws of physics are the same over all time. She said she her theorem could be exploited to say, oh, you know, the laws of physics are the same at all places in the universe. Immediately, this gives rise to what we know as Newton's first law of motion. Objects in motion stay in motion, objects at rest, and so on. She derived this. Things that had sort of been assumed to be sort of the most basic that you could get, she derived. Whenever we hear about things like now, grand unified theories or theories of everything or supersymmetry or any of these ideas, they are a matter of figuring out, starting out with assuming certain symmetries about the universe, and from there predicting particles and particle interactions. All of this stems from Noether.
And she said that she turned symmetry into order.
Yeah, so that's a wonderful way of doing it. It's an irony. I mean, the reason she wasn't allowed to sit in classes at Erlangen was because having women there, they said, would overturn all academic order. And, you know, she, I guess, proved them wrong.
So one of the reasons given for her not becoming as famous as Einstein is she did nothing to try to popularize her ideas.
She wrote very densely, I must say, even for a physicist to read, because she wanted to sort of put her ideas out there so that they were correct, that they were rigorous, and basically, you know, good luck with that. I mean, Newton, of course, famously wrote very densely as well. But, you know, it's also the case that she had the misfortune of dying quite young. And again, I think there were still prejudices based on her gender.
Now, we have practically no time left, but we've had Michio Kaku here talking about the equivalent of particle replacement symmetry, the sort of thing we saw in Star Trek. With those transporters, he said that he believes it is possible. Do you?
Well, I believe, yes, physically it's possible. So we've done it. We've teleported, and your listeners may be underwhelmed by this, we've teleported a whole photon at this, which is just a single particle of light. It's not as great as you might think. It's incredibly difficult. The signal can't travel faster than the speed of light, so it's not like you're going to be able to travel across the universe. And basically, as I say, the most complicated thing we've ever teleported is a single particle.
Okay, so I'm not going to go to Paris after all later this afternoon. David Goldberg is professor and director of undergraduate studies at the Department of Physics at Drexel University. His book, The Universe in the Rearview Mirror, How Hidden Symmetries Shape Reality, is published by Dutton. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a great pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, New York Times Dining Section columnist Melissa Clark will be here with some suggestions of ways to prepare eggplant. And then we'll talk to a trainer of bomb-sniffing dogs about how canines are taught to work in hazardous situations and why their noses are so sensitive. And then Nancy Davidson talks about the tales behind some of the missing cat posters that we see taped to light poles around the city. And we'll get the full story behind the controversial 1961 psychological experiment in which subjects were asked to administer electric shocks of increasing strength to another person. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Blake Neshek, Julia Corcoran, and Jessica Miller. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. We had help today from Todd McGovern, Hugh Sansom, and contributing producers Barbara Kahn and Fran Jacobs. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.